You're listening to the John C. Scott Political Forum. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Why did you take your car to Dirty Harry Auto Repair?
I don't know. They got a nice sign outside.
You know what? I smell a rat.
I'm here to pick up my car.
All right, I know what you're thinking, punk. Did I replace the cylinder head or just pretend I did? And what about the camshaft replacement? You'll never know. Go ahead. Pay for your car. Make my day, punk.
Don't get punked by Dirty Harry Auto Repair. Take your car to Perfection Auto Works, 323-8650.
Welcome to the John C. Scott Political Forum. John C. Scott is hosting one of the longest-running political talk shows in Arizona. This is the John C. Scott Political Forum on KVOI AM 1030, The Voice. And now, John C. Scott.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The 14th day of September, this portion of the John C. Scott Talk Show originates from the Perfection Auto Works Studios. Today, we'll talk with Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, Dimitri Downing, who's a pot lawyer, and Larry Bodine, blog for Arizona. We'll be talking about a candidate against Ali Miller for the Board of Supervisors, a Democrat that might possibly be able to beat her. Pamela Powers Hanley will be with us. She is a progressive legislator from Legislative District 9. Keith Rosenblum, who covers the border from Mexico, will be with us. Ed Ackerley, who is an independent candidate for mayor, will be here. We've got a very busy show. I love doing this show. I'm so glad you decided to join us. Let's talk with Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, and one of the best defense lawyers in America. Tucson, a sanctuary city. What does that mean? I don't understand that. What does that mean, Jeff Rogers?
Well, in this Proposition 205, it never actually defines what a sanctuary city is. It defines a lot of other things, like what a detention is and many other things, but it never tells us what a sanctuary city is. And there's no universal expectation that there is any kind of definition that controls what is and what's not a sanctuary city. So it's anybody's guess. It's kind of malleable. Whatever you think it means is what it means, I suppose. But the proposition itself is very specific in many of the things that it would do. And I think you're going to find out that virtually every civic and business organization in this city is going to put together a joint effort that is nonpartisan, including prior chairs of the Democratic Party, including myself, prior chairs and current chairs of the Republican Party, and many other business and civic leaders are going to mount a large-scale effort to defeat this because we all have our own worries. One of the biggest worries is that we could lose up to $150 million in state shared revenue because of violating other statutes within the Arizona Revised Statutes by implementing this measure. We could also lose tens of millions of dollars in shared revenue that we receive from the federal government. And in addition to these groups opposing it, the entire current mayor and council, including the candidate for mayor of the Democratic Party and the independent Ackerley, they all oppose it. There's only one candidate running for one city council seat that came out in favor of it, and that was Lane Santa Cruz from Ward 1. So I think that the opposition to this is huge. I think there are a lot of well-meaning people who really believe in their hearts that this is something that the city ought to do, and many of them might believe this is largely symbolic, but there are many of us who believe it could wreck the finances of the city of Tucson irreparably.
We know in a conversation I had with Raul Grijalva, the congressman from Congressional District 3, that he supports Tucson becoming a sanctuary city. We know what happens when Raul Grijalva gets behind something. It seems to work out pretty well. At least it did for the wife of his longtime chief of staff, as she won the nomination for mayor of Tucson of the Democratic Party. I don't know that Raul Grijalva is going to start calling people to get money from an outside source to support this sanctuary city movement. He could, I'm sure. I don't know that he will. There's a lot of people that just identify with babes being pulled from the arms of mothers, The horrible video and visual effects of the border every day, and think the sanctuary cities has something to do and say about that, but it doesn't, does it?
No, it doesn't, because it doesn't affect what the federal government does. It only affects what Tucson City Police and the Tucson City government does. So it has no effect on the federal government's activities, even within the city of Tucson and within the county of Pima. So it affects none of that, and it affects no border enforcement by the Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, and all of that. So it would have no effect on any of that. And I don't believe that Representative Grijalva is going to be able to convince Councilwoman Romero to change her mind. I mean, let's look back at when she became a councilperson. That was 2007. That was the election of 2007. That was the beginning of the worst recession since the Great Depression. Not only did we suffer an extraordinary loss of tax revenue generated by city taxes, but we also lost shared revenue from the state in the HERF money and other shared revenues that had traditionally come from the state and been shared with Tucson and with Pima County. And that council that took that year, seated in 2008, was, they had to make some extraordinarily difficult decisions fiscally. And this city, it really still hasn't recovered. I mean, we're still several hundred police officers shy of where we were at that point in time. But, we've recovered quite a lot since then. Due to the hard decisions made by the mayor and council during those troubling years. And I think Councilwoman Romero remembers that quite well. And the last thing she wants to do, should she become mayor, is to take over a city that instantly loses 20 to 30% of its discretionary revenue. You got to realize that even though we have a $1 billion plus budget, about half of that's not discretionary. It's money that has to be spent in certain manners that's dictated by law and policy.
We're talking with Jeff Rogers, the former chair of the Democratic Party, well-known defense lawyer. It seems to me that a great many people just didn't understand sanctuary cities. We still don't understand it. I mean, you've tried to explain it to us as clearly as you possibly can. But I think a lot of people have an image in their mind that this is a statement against Trump, a statement against what's happening at the border, a statement to the world that we're a friendly city, that we welcome refugees, migrant people, and whatever. And that's just not the case. That's not what this is about, but it's confusing to people. I'm really curious about your, the Republicans tried to challenge this, and they seemed to lean, had all kinds of legitimate reasons why this should never have been on the ballot. Did that surprise you after the opposition seemed to have a very clear and purposeful, approach to trying to get this off the ballot? Should never have been on the ballot in the first place.
Well, there's a legal argument there, but the lower courts have to follow rulings of the Supreme Court and that are published and rulings of the Court of Appeals that are published. And there's a fair amount of support for the fact that charter cities, as opposed to, smaller unchartered cities, that chartered cities can make certain kinds of decisions themselves and are not beholden to state law. And I believe that's where the judge got the reasoning for denying their challenge to this. It would have been interesting to take that challenge further up because the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have changed drastically since many of those rulings were issued years ago. And there might be a bit of a change of mind in the currently structured court, particularly the currently structured Supreme Court of Arizona. So, I was kind of disappointed that we didn't see some further litigation of that to sort of flesh it out and see where that goes. But if this thing passes, we're going to see a lot of litigation. And the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to ask Attorney General Brnovich whether or not this violates Senate Bill 1487. And if he makes a ruling that it does, we suddenly lose instantly well over $100 million in shared revenue from the state.
Wow.
And that's not money we can make up in an instant. And so that's, fiscally, that's the big danger. But there are other dangers lurking out there, too. Many people don't know that Homeland Security initiates most of the child sex trafficking and child pornography cases. Those cases are then often handed off once they've established that this internet activity took place, they're often handed off to local law enforcement agencies like the Sheriff's Department and the Tucson Police Department. This would ban us, the Tucson Police Department, from cooperating with these federal agencies in that regard. There are also legal, which puts children at risk. There are also legal opinions that it would not allow us to cooperate with the federal government in certain other areas, such as something called AFIS. That's the National Fingerprint Registry that's run by the federal government. If we didn't have access to that, then, you know, all kinds of crimes could not be solved. And we also have large grants that come into the county and the city and the prosecutor's office that allow us to cooperate with federal authorities in major drug trafficking endeavors. And so we would likely lose that as well and lose the ability to cooperate with those DEA agents, FBI agents, and other law enforcement agents when they focus upon these kinds of big crimes and big crime syndicates.
Let me take go ahead. I'm sorry.
There are just many, many areas like that that we could lose our ability to cooperate with them. Again, the CODIS, which is the National DNA Database, we would have no access to that. So if you find a crime that's been committed, let's say a rape, and you don't have it in your state database, but it's in the national database, we may not have access to that and may not be able to catch that criminal.
Wow. Let me take you to one other subject before I let you go, and that is, I don't know what the legacy of Doug Ducey is going to be as governor of this state. I would think it would be packing the Supreme Court. We've never seen anything like this, increasing the number of the Supreme Court, packing it with very conservative and right-wing folks. Montgomery's an example out of this, taking the county attorney out of Maricopa County, throwing him in the court. I mean, this Supreme Court has been changed forever. And the state of Arizona has been changed forever, and it seems like nobody paid any attention to this.
It'll be two generations before there's any real market change in this Supreme Court. And, you know, the only silver lining I can tell you up there is, you know, someone that we in the criminal defense community and lawyers in general were quite surprised at Clint Bolick, who used to be legal director at the Goldwater Institute. He's turned out to be a lot more refreshing judge on the Supreme Court than we, any of us, would have predicted. But it just goes to show sometimes people can be a little bit unpredictable when you appoint them and they don't turn out to be exactly what you thought they were.
Yeah, I've interviewed him a couple of times. They had conservative credentials or unchallenged, and I expected a great deal more movement to the right from him than we got. That is a surprise. But the court's going to be a very conservative court for decades, as you clearly point out. Generations, perhaps.
It definitely is. It definitely is.
Well, that's going to be amazing. Well, Jeff Rogers, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. This is going to be an interesting mayoral race as we come between Raina Romero and all the money that flowed into that campaign at the end of it in the Democratic primary. You know, I mean, we'll all go by this, but I think that's changed Tucson politics forever. We can always now know that third-party money can win an election or at least aid it dramatically in the last throes of a Democratic primary or any kind of primary. That's something we learned, didn't we?
We sure did, and I find that to be very depressing. Even though these are groups that I generally support, Planned Parenthood, various unions, I was disappointed to see them weigh in a primary. We have always known and expected that they would help us in every way possible in a general election against the Republicans, but I was just shocked that they picked sides in a local election like this, and I hope that doesn't happen again, but boy, it sure seems like it's on the horizon.
I believe it is. Jeff Rogers, thanks so much for being with us. I really appreciate your observations.
You're quite welcome.
I'm very pleased to talk with you. Thanks so much. Jeff Rogers, former chair of the Democratic Party, one of the best defense lawyers in America. This is KVOI The Voice, and this portion of the John C. Scott Show originates from the Perfection Auto Works Studios. The John C. Scott Political Forum is made possible with support from former Arizona Supreme Court Justice Stanley Fellman and from former Phoenix Suns owner Don Pitt and from Tucson civic and business leader Humberto Lopez. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Show. He's a lawyer. He's an authority on marijuana all across this great world of ours. He's Dimitri Downing. We always go to him when something big is happening. And you've got international conferences coming up. Dimitri, one in particular featuring Member of Parliament from the UK, and the CanEx Jamaica. That's coming up the 26th and 28th of September. I've always wanted to touch base with you when you have these international gatherings to, I guess, emphasize how worldwide the proliferation of legitimate and legalized marijuana is all across this great globe. Talk about the CanEx Jamaica, if you will, Dimitri.
Well, I got to be honest with you, John. That one's just a little bit of fun. It took a couple of days of knowledge and sharing information with other international people who are interested in the international policy and changes that are happening in cannabis. But, you know, you throw a couple extra days on there. So it was a little bit of fun. But we have some local stuff going on, too. Like Wednesday, the 18th, up in Phoenix, is a great way to learn about the cannabis space. From 5 to 8 at the Foundry Hotel, 25 vendors, ancillary brands, dispensaries get together and network, about 200 industry professionals and 100 looky-loos. So the public can always learn about that and what's happening locally in Arizona at www.meta-az.org. The international conferences are great. The Jamaica one is amazing. I mean, you have the head of the UK. You got the head of Mexico. You got a lot of interesting individuals that that come down there, as well as lots of business people, because they figure it's a great place to network. You know, it could be worse.
Tell me
Johnny Cash's old house and stuff.
Really? Tell me about Illinois and what the struggle is in the Midwest state as they move into the world of legitimate marijuana sales. What's happening in Illinois? That's a big story and a lot of money involved.
Yeah, well, I posted this one on my Facebook. I'm thinking about posting all of them on my Facebook. There's more and more opportunities coming available to citizens, although Illinois is $200,000 for a licensing fee. So, like, the gig is out or the jig is up, whatever. People are realizing the value, including states. So they're charging $200,000 for an application fee, recognizing that the 75 winners of these adult use licenses are going to be making, you know, millions upon millions, especially in limited license jurisdictions like Illinois. So the gig is up there. What's the phrase that they use? The jig is out?
Something like that. Jig is up. We'll probably call it up. Who cares? Yes. Fine.
So Illinois, it's happening. No real controversy unless you wanted to say that, you know, having limited licenses is a controversy, or you wanted to say that charging $200,000 is a controversy. But, you know, if you reflect on it from the perspective of the state, that license is worth millions of dollars. So why shouldn't the state sell it at value? So $200,000 is essentially a bargain. But they are just applications. They're not actually licenses being issued yet. So you have to pay $200,000 just to apply. So, you know, other people might say it's controversial to not allow, you know, poor people to have access to licenses. And that's, you know, that is kind of controversial, depending on your perspective. You know, if you're a believer in more of a free market approach and opportunistic approach, you want to make things as cheap as possible, if not free. You know, I've learned a lot about economics in the last 7 years in the cannabis industry. And one thing I've discovered is that you really want to help disenfranchised folk. You know, even if you have, like, special programs that are available from the government or inexpensive licensing, you know, the real poor people, the real uneducated, the real disenfranchised, you know, it's better for them to have a free market because they can, you know, they have less barriers to understand or to pay for to get involved in, say, selling tomatoes. But, so that's Illinois. Illinois is a new marketplace. That's like the 11th or 13th adult use marketplace. There's 30-some-odd medicinal marketplaces, and they're all coming online, and they're using different market structures. And it should be a little more controversial, but I can't get enough people to care, so. What are you going to do?
Well, let me ask you a little bit about Arizona, because obviously we're approaching 2020, in which more than likely the recreational marijuana will be on the ballot. It apparently is not going to be authored or structured in any way by the legislature. It's going to be put together by those who are supporting that effort. Tell me who is actually writing this, and tell me why it might differ from what the legislature would do, and why there's a pretty good argument for both. Let the legislature write it, call it a referendum, then they can change it. They don't have to go back every time to deal with changes that are going to have to be made, unless it obviously is the part of an initiative, which you have to change by a vote of the people. So the decision that people are going to make in 2020 in the state of Arizona for recreational marijuana, talk about that option.
Well, I'll give it to you from the what's best for the state of Arizona perspective.
Yes.
And, you know, so it could go to the legislature, and that would be what's best for the general state of Arizona as a whole. The referendum process to the legislature, and that would also be good for Arizona, depending on how the referendum is written and how many things were subject to legislative review as they write their referendum. You know, you can write things out of, assuming not legislative review, the 51% versus 75% aspect of why it makes an initiative bad. And all initiatives are subject to the same criticism, that when you have, or some people would actually perceive it as a good thing, when you have a situation where it takes 75% to change it and it has to be within the spirit of law. I would argue that, you know, it should take 51% to change it and it should be within the spirit of law, and that's sufficient. That would actually be a better way to have the Voter Protection Act, but the Voter Protection Act isn't written like that. It's within 75%. So right now there's an initiative on the ballot, which is an unfortunate necessity for the state of Arizona. It's not the best way to do it, but it's the only way to do it, because you can't get the public officials who are still stuck in their mindset that somehow prohibition is a management tool that's going to one day come back, to talk about rational and reasonable medical and adult use marijuana policy. If they would engage, then we could have some really adult conversations. Right now you have, you know, our industry and those advocates for medical adult use, all other forms of marijuana, pushing forward initiatives, which is fine, which is a necessity, because of the fact that you don't have those who would somehow think that prohibition is going to come back participating in a public debate. You have them saying prohibition or bust. So right now, if you were to ask Governor Ducey about this, he would probably say prohibition or bust. That's just not a realistic approach. So yes, we will have a governance through the initiative process. If Governor Ducey wanted to take the lead, he could take the lead. If I was Governor Ducey, I would take the lead. If Governor Ducey wants any help, he can call me and I'll help him take the lead, because it's not always black and white. You know, there are lots of nuances to this marijuana discussion. And as you know, I don't come at it from a state or an industry necessarily perspective, at least not when I come on your show, because your people want to know what's best for the state of Arizona. So I come at it like both sides. And if an intelligence discussion was had, we could come up with probably a model marijuana policy that's something beyond adult use, something beyond recreational use, something beyond medicinal use, something beyond prohibition. We can have a discussion about what is the ideal policy for, and you know, and after 7 years of studying this stuff, John, it's not just the ideal policy for marijuana, it's the ideal policy probably for most substances. And yes, a lot of it has to do with education, but most of it has to do with messaging, most of it has to do with packaging, most of it has to do with marketing. Prohibition and kind of hiding stuff, it's just not ever going to work. It's just not going to work. So you have to look from there as to what kind of world you want to design. I can't get enough intelligence. I mean, well, actually, you know what? I'll tell you what, a lot of them understand, but the political will isn't there to do anything. So you have people hiding behind politics, like, oh, you know, my base doesn't understand that prohibition is dead, so I'm not going to deal with it. That's the reality that I'm stuck in, what I'm trying to sit here and do what's best for the state of Arizona, because ultimately I'm not going to be here, but other people will, right? You know, so.
Well, let me ask you this,
John.
I think most people who would say.
Well, I ran for office a long time ago.
I know, I remember that. We all remember that. I did the same thing. A lot of people would say, look, if we're going to have legalized recreational marijuana, we want it to be safe. We want it to be pure as much as it can be. We want to have it identified completely with all the options that are available. We want to know everything we can about what will be sold to my neighbors or to myself. I don't think that's unfair. I think we need to have all of it to be in front of us as we make this decision, don't you?
No, nothing wrong with that. I mean, we have that in automobiles.
Sure.
When you go look at the plate, the whatever thing I call the window sticker at the dealerships, we have that on food products. We have that, you know. I mean, there's certain, like, you know, I mean, do we know where the sand from the glass came for the windshields that are at the automobiles? Probably not. You probably could research that if you want to. BMW probably gets its sand from the sandy beaches of Barbados where, you know, Honda probably gets the sand from the rocky beaches of, yeah, I'm just joking here. But you see my point.
Sure.
You can go into the minutiae if you want to. And certainly in marijuana, like any other substance, like coffee, you know, where do your coffee beans come from? What are they grown with? Are there pesticides? You know, you can go to the nth level. But marijuana is a substance that's a little bit more powerful and a little bit more impactful, like coffee, like alcohol, like aspirin. that needs to have a little bit more regulation. That's acceptable. This is what we do as society. So, yes, people deserve to have all that, and they will get that in a tax and regulate market. They will never get that in a prohibition-based market. So when Governor Ducey or any of these individuals say, we want prohibition, we don't want tax and regulate, they are effectively saying, we are denying you a marketplace where you can actually know what's coming to you, and you're going to be subject to the traditional criminal thing. Everybody knows for the last 30 or 40 years, even when we were in high school in the 80s and 90s and 70s, you can go get pot wherever you want to on the black market. You never knew where it was coming from. Prohibition just did not work as a management model. People have to accept that, okay? Once you accept that reality, there's a lot more to discuss, a lot more different realities to discuss. And if you do not get involved in the conversation is going to happen on top of you. And that's the reality. And while I could sit here and just keep my mouth shut and say, you know what, it's all going to happen, we kick back and let it happen, I also have a duty to the state of Arizona. And I know people on your show, listening to your show, political leaders across the state of Arizona, across the city, I encourage them to engage, get involved, understand that these things are happening, and market structures are being created out of a, you know, thin air that, you know, are going to impact the society, just like market structures for, you know, asphalt or anything else. So
let me ask you about what is unfolding in California, where we see this massive state and this huge economy and the rollout of the recreational marijuana economy, as you can call it. It's an economy in itself. It is also a massive undertaking by a state that is, you just can't even describe California today. It's like a fifth largest country in the world. Tell me what's happening in California we can learn from as we move into Arizona's legalization of marijuana, perhaps in 2020.
Well, you know, I mean, California is such a diverse market with so many different interests, and there are so many gray market operators and at Humboldt County, and you got illegal college growers, and you had the medicinal marijuana guys, and you had, there's so many different aspects about it. They tried to take care of everybody, but it's almost impossible. You know, you're, because you have all these, the process of transitioning from tax and regulate, from black market, or dark market, as I say, if you're politically correct, from dark market to tax and regulate medicinal, to tax and regulate adult use. There's so many nuances to it. It's hard for the government to get right. It's hard for people to even understand these marketplaces, let alone regulate them. So California has made a lot of mistakes, which we can learn from. But they're mistakes that shouldn't inhibit the process, or shouldn't stop the process of going towards prohibition. They're mistakes that should say, okay, we're going to end prohibition. Let's look at California and all the other mistakes that might have been made in the process, so that we can do it better. Like, for example, if you want to end prohibition, you better set the tax rate to the tax rate that's appropriate so people don't go towards the black market, so they participate in the tax and regulate market. That has nothing to do with keeping prohibition. It has to do with how does ending prohibition work. So, you know, you need a reasonable tax rate that's going to motivate or incentivize people to go to the places the government is allowing for it to be sold. If the government is engaged in allowing places to be sold, some people would argue that it should be able to be sold anywhere. So that's like a little nuance that you got to get right. California taxed it at like seven different levels. In Arizona, we're taxing it at two different levels, which is good. It's smart. Our people learn from that. We're going to get that right. But we had that right even before California's recreational initiative. They're just initiative is dumb. There's a lot of stuff they did was like government overreach and people believing that somehow government could get so actively involved in the marketplace and solve all kinds of problems. That's not necessarily true. You know, so our initiative is a little bit more libertarian based. Is it libertarian based enough? Probably not. So that's one of the little nuances. Let me give you another quick nuance, and there's hundreds out there. Civil versus criminal penalties for those not participating in the tax and regulate market. What happens to people who don't participate in tax and regulate market, whether it's consumption, transportation, processing, or cultivation? If you're doing any of those four things, what is your punishment? Well, a logical argument can be made from all the way to you get your hands cut off, all the way to you get a dollar fine, okay? Somewhere, and it's civil. So you got criminal over here, capital. You can go capital, too, capital, criminal, or civil. So you can have these massive debates as to whether or not you're going to incentivize people to participate in tax regulated market by either fining them for a dollar civilly if they don't participate properly, or cutting their hands off. This is the kind of discussion that's had when you're dealing with changing laws
from prohibition to tax and regulate. Not discussions that have that happen too often. This is why the legislature and the governor needs to have these discussions. Yeah, our initiative is probably has a pretty good model. I forgot what it is right off the top of my head. But it's all over the place. And it's very important to get it right, because this is going to determine how your system works.
Hey, very quickly, as we end this conversation, I'm almost out of time. How big is the medical marijuana industry in the state of Arizona? How fast has it grown from its inception?
Well, it arguably hasn't grown. What was medical marijuana and adult use marijuana was happening on the gray market, the black market, the dark market, prior to its creation. But it's a $500 million tax and regulate market, and when it goes legal, we'll be able to bring the other $500 million into a tax and regulate fold. So it's going to be about a $1 billion market.
Dimitri Downing, thank you so very much for your authority. Thank you so much for your observations. It's always great to talk with you. I appreciate it very much. People are very appreciative of you coming on the air and talking about this, and they're informed because you do. Thank you so much. All right. Dimitri Downing, Tucson attorney. We'll be back with more of the John C. Scott Political Forum. The John C. Scott Political Forum is made possible with support from the Republican National Committeeman Bruce Ash, and from former Democratic Chairman Don Jorgensen, and from the Mayor of Tucson, Jonathan Rothschild. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the John C. Scott Political Forum on this Saturday afternoon. I'm so glad you could join us. Let's talk with Larry Bodine of Blog for Arizona. Blog for Arizona, said by the Washington Post to be the very best blog in all of Arizona, is a progressive blog. You want to know what progressives are thinking? Go to Arizona Blog. It's Blog for Arizona. That's where you go. And here's Larry Bodine. Larry, thanks for being with us. I noticed you were reporting that looks like Allie Miller, the Republican firebrand, I guess, supervisor, is going to get a Democratic opponent who seems pretty reasonable and a legitimate candidate to unseat her in 2020.
Yes, that's right. I did an interview with Rex Scott, who is a career educator and principal in Pima County, and he's put in a notice of intent to run for District 1 supervisor, where Allie Miller is the current incumbent. Allie Miller is basically a sort of a reclusive, bitter, isolated figure. You know, she refuses to speak to news reporters, has really no positive record to speak of. And I really think that Rex Scott will be a breath of fresh air.
By the way, Larry, when the board redistricted, did the redistricting of all of the five supervisor seats, they took a lot of Republicans and dumped them into Allie Miller's ward to get them out of the other wards to protect the three Democrats, Bronson and the other two. Obviously, that makes it a little more of an uphill battle for any Democrat to win in that district.
You make a good point, John. The district includes Marana, Oro Valley, and the Foothills. It's primarily a Republican-leaning district with 54,000 Republicans, 46,000 Democrats, but importantly, 41,000 independents. And Scott told me that's where he's going to focus his attention, is on the independents, as well as what he calls the persuadable Republicans. Interesting footnote is that while he's been a registered voter for 27 years, in the early stages of his life, he was a moderate to liberal Republican, and joined the Democratic Party after he moved to Arizona about 15 years ago. So he's a guy who can talk to Republicans. He's known in the more conservative areas of Oro Valley and Marana, and he's been the principal at Ironwood Ridge High School and Tortolina Middle School. So he's got some name recognition there with Republicans. It remains to be seen, what happens. But the early morning bets are that Scott has a pretty good chance.
Yeah, I've heard really good things about him. And, of course, reading the blog for Arizona, I picked up on the information you had from your interview. He's a very, I think, likable person, as well as a very formidable person, I think, on the stump. I think he's going to do a great job of campaigning. He seems to like it, and that's an important step forward. Allie Miller doesn't necessarily like it and doesn't like much of anything. I think that a lot of the business community just had it with her negativity for the Board of Supervisors and are ready just to move on beyond Ollie Miller. She said some horrible things about people, has been really a divisive figure on the board, and it's probably time to have somebody that's going to be a lot more effective on the Board of Supervisors than Ms. Miller. So I think people are looking forward to this campaign.
I would say, you know, Miller campaigns primarily within the, no reporters allowed meetings with the Pima County Tea Party, which she founded. And her outward campaign consists primarily of road signs that have a picture of her from 20 or 25 years ago. And, you know, the bottom line is when you look at her record, she's really accomplished nothing in the office. She's best known for voting against the county budget every time it comes up. And she's got some pie-in-the-sky plan to fix county roads, you know, except it would require an act of the legislature and a general referendum in Pima County. So her road plan has really not gathered a whole lot of support. And really the best thing Miller is known for is saying, "I'm white and proud of it." And she said this immediately after a Nazi used a car to murder a protester at that rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Oh, my God. By the way, Sean's on the phones. Sean, welcome to the John C. Scott Show. You're with Larry Bodine of Blog for Arizona. Thanks for your call, Sean.
Larry, Captain Kirk, I'm sorry. Allie's been on my show 3 times, and I'm going to tell you what you can't tell me. I'm on tomorrow. You can't tell me who I would vote for from Kennedy to Reagan. Allie's been on my show. She's completely transparent. And for you to say she will not get in front of, and I'm not a reporter, I'm a guy with a radio show. She's been on my show 3 times. She's completely honest with the audience. I don't know where's this come from, sir?
Well, wait, don't you have a right-wing fringe radio show where Allie comes on and basically just insults other people?
You know what, dude? Don't put
people.
Words in my mouth. Jackass. I'm not a right-wing fringe.
Don't be calling people jackass on my show.
I'm not a right-wing fringe.
Sean?
I'm a libertarian.
Sean? Don't call people a jackass on this show, okay?
Well, but he called me a right-wing fringe, John.
Well,
you know I'm not.
Well, don't call him a jackass, all right? Let's move on from there.
Well, but he called me names.
All right, fine. Yeah, fine. All right, what? Make your point.
Saying Allie's been transparent with the audience in Brush Friars of Freedom. She's not as scared of people coming on and talking to her.
Allie has made some disparaging remarks about people that were beyond the pale, absolutely disgusting remarks about people that just literally, I think, discredited her as not only an individual that should have the kind of responsibility she has, but makes her almost unqualified to be a public figure, in my opinion. I followed her career from the very, very beginning, believe me.
So, and so have I. But, Larry, I mean, you're saying she won't come on, and she has. I've invited Martha McSally on my show. She won't come on. I mean, are you going to say anything about Martha? Air Force veteran?
Yeah, sure. Martha McSally is trailing in the polls for the first time. She's trailing behind Mark Kelly, who scored a 46% favorability in a brand-new poll, and Martha's kind of fallen behind 41%. Why do you think she's falling behind?
In my personal opinion, I do believe that politicians, in my opinion, this is my opinion, they need to come out and be on not only John's show, but my show, everybody's show. They need to come out and take questions from the audience, in my opinion, Larry.
So you really have no explanation, you know, other than the fact that, you know, McSally, as you pointed out, is not somebody who has held any kind of a public town hall in the area. She basically has glued herself onto Trump. She's, Trump in high heels. And I think the voters in Arizona are pretty tired of Martha McSally. You know, she's our unelected senator, and they like the fresh new ideas from Mark Kelly.
Well, I did have a good idea. I say that people that are elected need to get in front of their constituents, Larry.
Yes,
please don't put words in my mouth.
All right. Well, I think it's
a good idea for people that are elected representatives to get on shows like John's or mine and explain their views to the people they quote-unquote represent.
I'm not so sure Ollie Miller is going to be on my show soon. I've asked her, I don't know, maybe a dozen times. She has refused every time, so it takes two. You know what I mean?
You are correct,
John?
Sir. No, you're correct, John.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, guys. You guys have a great day.
Thank you, Sean. Let me ask you about the Democratic debate before I let you go, Larry Beaudin. What did you see, and what impressed you out of this this latest gathering of Democrats?
Well, I think I've read every news article there is, as well as watching the debates.
Right.
And my take on it was that Elizabeth Warren really stepped forward and came up in people's estimation. You know, it's the race has really boiled down to, you know, the top three, which is Biden, Warren, and Bernie. The difference with Warren is that when she doesn't attack other people. You notice she didn't attack Biden. She's well versed, confident, a good storyteller. For instance, when she talked about the U.S. should pull out of Afghanistan, regardless of whether there's a deal with the Taliban, she basically said, you know, you can't bomb your way to a solution, and that she had three brothers in the military, and that there is no military solution in Afghanistan. And she says, you can't ask her brothers who put their lives on the line, that you cannot ask them to solve a problem that they cannot. So she's got a really good way of taking these really big public issues and sort of boiling them down into something really simple in terms of health insurance, for example. You know, she'll say that, you know, when the insurance companies tell you no, they make a profit. And that really sort of crystallizes her whole approach. The only detriment I see for Warren is that she supports Medicare for all, which is an interesting ideal, but it is not popular with the public. It's not popular when you present it as something that's a replacement for private health insurance. You've got 150 million Americans who have private insurance, primarily through their job. And, you know, on this point, I think Biden has a much better position, that people can keep their private health insurance from their employers, but if they lose that, they have an opportunity to buy in to Medicare, so you don't have to go uninsured.
You know, we're going to face a crisis in America as the Republicans continue to eat away at Obamacare and make it so almost untenable, unaffordable, and unlikable in America. There's not going to be much hope for it unless we can get it. I mean, nobody ever stepped forward and said, let's fix what's wrong with Obamacare. It's a good basis to begin with. Let's fix it, because many parts of it are broken. But we're going to have nothing in America. Nothing that protects you against pre-existing conditions if you want insurance. Nothing that's going to protect you when it comes to affordable health care. We're just not going to do it. The Republicans have no plan. I mean, they just have no plan.
Yeah, the Trump plan is no health insurance for people. It's also for cutting back water pollution and auto pollution, cutting back into the Endangered Species Act, a failed foreign policy with China, Korea, Venezuela, Afghanistan. So it's a record of failure and tax breaks for the rich. I really don't see that the Trump plan really has anything positive in it.
You know, as far as watching these people in this debate, I mean, we're getting to a particular point where we're going to have to cull this down to at least five or six. Is that where it's going to wind up here before we go into 2020, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the Iowa in February, we'll be having the Iowa caucuses, the New Hampshire primary, the Nevada caucuses. So it's really between now and February that any one of these candidates has a chance to distinguish themselves. And at this point, I think it really sort of breaks down to Biden. Rank-and-file Democrats like Biden because he's 100% certain to beat Trump. And I've gone to watch parties sponsored by the Warren, sponsored by Harris here in Tucson. And, you know, when I ask people, who do you like, they just whisper, they say, you know, I'll vote for anybody who can beat Trump. And so far, that's the leading advantage of Joe Biden. He can carry those states of Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The guy can appeal to the working white middle class. And he's liked by moderates and older Americans as well as African Americans.
You know, you had Castro, the Texan, going after Biden, talking about his age when he accused the former vice president of forgetting a detail about his own health care plan. Of course, Biden's, I think, 70, 76, if I'm not mistaken. He'd be the oldest president ever elected to a first term. And, of course, Castro was saying, are you forgetting what you just said 2 minutes ago? I can't believe you said that 2 minutes ago and you've forgotten it. And that's going to come up in these debates over and over again. I don't know how effective that's going to be, but everybody knows what his age is.
I don't think it'll be very effective. From everything that I've read, there was a real negative response by Castro's attack on Biden. It was considered a cheap shot. And, my God, I can't believe standing in front of an auditorium full of people with the press asking you questions, how you could avoid from getting flustered. It's clear that Biden gets flustered on certain questions. He comes up with responses that are kind of a word salad and, you know, sometimes doesn't respond to the point. But when it comes down to overall likability, which is really the bottom line in getting elected to anything, Biden has a lot of that, and I think Warren, more and more people are finding a good way to like her.
We're talking with Larry Bodine of the blog for Arizona. The leading Democratic candidates may not have another chance, Larry, to face off for quite a while. The field may be divided into two groups when they meet again in October because there's more than 10 candidates qualified for the next round. So you may have 12 or 13, and you split that up. But it's going to be a while. It'll be almost a full month before they all meet again. I don't know how effective these are. Do you think they're really a revelation as to who is who and what is what and what they're all about? Or is it just moments in time that are just clipped out of particular minutes of debate from just one candidate to another, then back to another candidate or not? I mean, does it make any sense to do it this way? Do we learn anything?
I think that the Democrats should be much more stricter about the amount of support and donations that you've gotten. I think they've made it too easy to get on the stage. But that said, I give kudos to the Democratic Party for making all of these candidates available. So if you are interested in one of the candidates, you can see them on stage and see what they say in comparison to the other candidates. But, you know, to some degree, you're right, John, that it is a moment in time. You know, they take all these polls immediately after the debates. But, you know, the point is the election is more than a year away. It's still way early in the game. I think I read somewhere that Clinton didn't even announce his campaign until 13 months before the election.
Wow.
So if this were back in the Clinton days, he wouldn't even be on the stage at all.
Larry Bodine, it's so good to talk with you. I appreciate it. I want people to go to Blog for Arizona. You want to get a perspective on the progressive thinking in Arizona, you just go to Blog for Arizona. You guys do a great job of reporting what's going on out there within the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, and I appreciate that so very much. Everything's well written. It's well put together. It's just a great information place to go to find out what progressives are thinking, and you do a wonderful job. And you need some help. If people will support you, they can go to Blog for Arizona and find out how to donate to your effort, because you need to be supported, and I'm sure you will be.
Well, thank you. We're all citizen journalists working to get the stories online that the daily papers don't cover, and you can just go to blogforarizona.net, and on the home page in the top right is a box where you can donate. And it all goes to keeping the site online. Nobody gets paid anything from it.
Well, thank you so much, Larry Bodine. Great work. Thank you so much. We'll be back with more of the John C. Scott Show following the news at the top of the hour. This portion of the John C. Scott Talk Show originates from the Profession Auto Works Studios.